From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a legal observer tells about a violent encounter with the Detroit Police Department during ongoing protests.
It feels like there's a lawlessness, but that lawlessness is within the Detroit Police Department.
And we'll meet the host of a new podcast that questions whether immigrants to the United States are finding a better life here.
I mean, not that I was ever rah-rah America, but I always thought, okay, like, this is a place where immigrants can find a better life. I'm not really so sure anymore.
And we're days away from the school year beginning for all students in Michigan. There's still so many great unknowns.
There's a lot of concern among traditional public school leaders. They're going to lose significant numbers of students to private schools and to other kinds of school options.
Those conversations and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the state's preparedness for the K-12 school year against the backdrop of a profound decline in state revenue.
Got districts saying, how many schools will we have to shut down? Are we going to have to lay off a few teachers? Are we talking about laying off 20% of our teachers?
That conversation's coming up later in the program. But first, the nation once again finds itself this week traumatized by a video of a Black American shot by police. Across the country, protests have taken on a new fervor after Jacob Blake was injured by officers in Kenosha, Wisconsin. His spinal cord was severed in the incident. In Detroit, protests had already been fairly tense over the past few days, following the arrest of several dozen people after months of mostly nonviolent action in the streets. In addition, several legal observers were beaten by police. Legal observers are folks who attend protests wearing clothing that marks them as being there in a citizen oversight capacity. Sarah Habo is on the board of the National Lawyers Guild. She's an employment attorney in Southfield, and she volunteers as a legal observer. Sarah Habo, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the work that legal observers do?
Yeah, so the legal observer program actually has been in existence since the 1970s. And what we do is provide on-the-street neutral legal observation and documentation of police behavior to ensure that the rights of citizens exercising their First Amendment rights to protest are protected against unlawful arrests and police misconduct.
Yeah. How long have legal observers been on the streets in Detroit? Does this go back to springtime when the protests first began?
So as soon as the marches began following the killing of George Floyd and then Breonna Taylor, yes, the legal observers have been out there legal observing the protests locally.
About how many people are engaged, do you think?
As legal observers?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, we have a ton of legal observers, probably over 70.
Right. And folks may have seen the bright green hats as they've been looking at videos on Twitter or maybe on TV of some of the protests. As legal observers are at work in the streets, can you tell us a little bit more about the form that their documentation takes? Are they taking notes or doing videos and photos or maybe both?
Yeah, we let our legal observers freestyle, basically. They can either handwrite notes, many do. Some are using voice recording on their phones or a recording device, and others also do phone recordings. I often use my camera.
There was an incident this past Saturday in which police were not just getting physical with protesters in Detroit. They also had contact with some of your observers. Can you tell us a little more about what happened?
Yeah, and I'll just focus on around the time of the arrests. And we were on Woodward Avenue, and basically the warnings that Detroit police gave to the protesters and everyone present were that people should leave the street and that they could remain so long as they were on the sidewalks. And our legal observers moved to the sidewalks because we want to be out there as long as possible to document what's happening. And at that point, we had three legal observers who were on Woodward. I believe they were closer to the Clifford John R. side. And one of the things that occurred was around June, around the time of the start, is we contacted Deputy Chief Bettison to ensure that our legal observers would not be arrested because two had been arrested at the end of May. And he gives assurance that they wouldn't be arrested, they wouldn't be impeded. And so three of our observers stated that, repeated it very loudly. And in response, the police officers hit one of our legal observers with a baton a couple times. Another one was hit with a police shield being used as a weapon. And then all three of them, who just happened to be together, were sprayed with pepper spray directly in their faces. And then one of our observers on the opposite side of the street was arrested.
Do you have any indication of the police's rationale for why they acted this way?
I honestly don't. I know that during the police conference that Chief Craig stated that it's difficult to identify who is who during these events. But during that time in June, when we contacted Deputy Chief Bettison, we included a photo. So they have a photo of the hats, and we were told that they were disseminating the photo among their staff so that they all knew, you know, what the hats meant and what we would be doing. And the fact that we don't participate in the protests, that we don't impede the police officers from doing whatever they are doing. We literally stand on the side and document. And when that was repeated to one of the officers, he replied, Deputy Chief Bettison isn't here.
Have you been able to get any formal answers from the department since Saturday about what happened?
We've reached out to Deputy Chief Bettison, and his response has been that he is troubled by what happened, but that wasn't the statement that he made during the press conference with Chief Craig.
Can you describe what he said?
Well, one of the things that was said was that they wanted the protesters to just leave, that whatever they were doing wasn't working, and that was what Deputy Chief Bettison said. But he made no comments about the fact that legal observers were arrested and were beaten and were sprayed directly in the face. And also, you know, Chief Craig stated that basically if you are out there during a protest, expect to be abused. And that's not how the Constitution works.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about how you've seen conditions at the protest evolve over the past couple of weeks? Have you noticed any specific changes, maybe even within the past 7 days?
To be totally honest with you, the protesters have, from our view, and again, legal observers have been present at every single march that they have had. And the constant theme is that they're choosing nonviolence, that it's not necessarily peaceful, but the civil rights movement wasn't peaceful either. And so it's really important to distinguish the fact that, you know, they're committed to nonviolence, but this isn't going to be a peaceful change.
We've heard some phrasing from Chief Craig suggesting that he doesn't want Detroit to become, in his words, like Seattle. And he's referring to the area in downtown Seattle in which protesters were basically given to understand that they would be in control of the situation and it would be a no-go zone for the police. From your observation, has there been any indication that longtime activists were designing or planning to try to start something like that in Detroit?
The main thing that demonstrators have expressed during these movements has been that they just want justice, they want equity, and that's been the theme, is they want a community that is safe and that they don't feel like the Detroit Police Department creates a community that's safe.
It feels like there's a pretty big divide in the country right now about people who look at protests in Seattle, in Portland, or, you know, maybe even in Detroit, and see a sense of lawlessness. Is that what you see?
It feels like there's a lawlessness, but that lawlessness is within the Detroit Police Department. The fact that a deputy chief of police can give assurances to an organization, and then the officers on the scene of, you know, an event can just decide not to honor that, that to me seems like lawlessness.
At the same time, if you know, in your time observing street protests, you know that an awful lot can be going on in several different places at once. There may be three quarters of a march that, you know, stretches a half a mile or so that are completely nonviolent, in which people are protesting, you know, and in a way that is supportive of each other and of the community. And then maybe there's one portion of the march that breaks off and does something that the rest of the protesters wouldn't agree with. Is it possible that that's what's also happening within the department's ranks as well?
I can't speak to what's happening with the Detroit Police Department, you know, any more than what I've experienced. And it just feels like the Detroit Police Department is trying to prevent legal observers from being able to document what's happening. And that, to me, is incredibly troubling.
Sarah, you said that DPD is acting, in your view, with a lawlessness. Is there anything else that you'd like people to know about things that you've witnessed as a legal observer at these protests?
One of the things that happened was, you know, during the press conference, Police Chief Craig stated that, you know, they used smoke initially. But while I was down there, I was gassed two separate times. You know, my face was burning, my eyes were burning. And when we were down there and trying to regroup with each other, there were visitors who were downtown on scooters, and we saw them coming toward us where the gas was still really strong. And we actually had to tell them to leave because it looked like they were experiencing symptoms from the gas. And the fact that, you know, the Detroit Police Department says, you know, they're fine with visitors coming downtown, but they, you know, at the same time are willing to just gas people downtown. Like, to me, that feels like the police department is okay with visitors coming downtown to enjoy the city. But when they're down there, they're subject to the Detroit Police Department. And they've made comments multiple times about the fact that these protesters don't live in the city. But if I'm visiting in the city and I'm subject to the Detroit Police Department, then I should be able to hold them accountable too. So I just want to make sure that that distinction is really made, the fact that they talk about where the protesters live, but, you know, everyone can go into any city and we're subject to the police who are working in those cities. And if they commit acts of violence against us, you know, I should be able to state that I'm not okay with that.
Sarah Habo is an attorney based in Southfield and also volunteers as a legal observer. Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Just note that we reached out to the Detroit Police Department for comment. We'll be glad to have Chief Craig on the show when he can speak with us about the protests. In just a minute, a new podcast checks in with people who came to the United States for opportunity and who've lately had cause to reconsider their thinking.
Is a better life still possible, given the economic anxieties, given who's been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19?
The host of A Better Life joins us in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The soul searching going on during this pandemic is so multi-layered. Is there anything that you're not rethinking right now? Your job, your household expenses, maybe a child's education, your relationships, or just how you move through the world? A new podcast series is exploring those reflections through the eyes of people who came to America seeking more. The podcast from the production company Feet in Two Worlds is called A Better Life. That's A Better Life with a question mark at the end. And it's hosted by Zahir Jen Mohammed. Zahir's a writer of fiction, poetry, and more. He's currently a Zell Writing Fellow at the University of Michigan. He's done extensive work in advocacy and education. He also co-created the podcast Racist Sandwich, which was nominated for a James Beard Award. Zahir Jen Mohammed joins us now from his pandemic perch. Zahir, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you mind telling us sort of where you are and how you are, just sort of how you've been holding up during the pandemic?
Sure, no problem. So I am in Portland, Maine. My wife is a professor at Bowdoin, and I'm doing okay. You know, Maine hasn't really been hit that bad, so at least for some residents, which I can get into later. But I'm doing okay. I think at the start of the pandemic, it was hard for me to leave Michigan. I'm deeply attached to Michigan. And so March was kind of this sudden, like, upheaval in my life, but I've kind of gotten into a rhythm of pandemic life. And I have to say, this podcast that I've been doing has helped me channel some of my anxieties through reporting the show. And it's allowed me to ask questions about what's happening in this country that, even though I was born and raised in the U.S., there's so many things I don't really get about the U.S. anymore.
You start out the podcast right there in episode one, acknowledging that you have some grounding in these conversations that you're having with people in the podcast. Your family has early roots in India, but your mom and dad grew up in Tanzania. And by the time you came along, your folks had settled on the West Coast in Sacramento. What kinds of things did you feel like you understood about the present moment, and what kinds of things did you want to find out with the people that the podcast is interviewing?
Sure. So I think growing up, one of the fundamental things that I never really questioned was that the U.S. was the best place that we could end up. But at the start of the pandemic, I remember getting a phone call from one of my cousins back home in Tanzania. And it was like, he was like, "We're really nervous about you. And we're really worried about your health. Are you guys okay? We're seeing the numbers." And I was thinking, oh my gosh, growing up, I worried about my family back home in East Africa. And now, because of the crumbling infrastructure in the US, the healthcare problems in this country, they were worried about us. And so I kept thinking, like, and I kept hearing immigrants, including my parents, asked the question, like, well, what if we hadn't come to the U.S.? Would we be safer? Would we be less vulnerable? And then, of course, with the election, those questions are just amplified, given that anti-immigrant rhetoric, unfortunately, is such a staple part of American life in 2020.
The first family that we meet in the podcast is a mother and daughter, and the daughter lives in New York, and her mom lives in Colorado, and her mom was originally from South Korea. And one of the things that they share is that they both love the movie Dirty Dancing, but they're also sort of sharing this conversation about the paths that their lives have taken. Could you tell us about them?
Yeah, sure. So that's our producer, Mia Warren, and her mother, Hija. And Hija is debating about whether or not she should move back to Korea. Korea has managed to contain the coronavirus. And Hija's wondering, well, does she stay close to her kids or does she go back to Korea where she might feel safer and get better health care? And there was a bit of worry that she might have even had COVID. So there was a lot of anxiety that she was facing. And I feel like a lot of the people that we've interviewed have been weighing these conversations, like, should I stay or should I go? Some people, like Hija, have said, well, they'll stay in the U.S. They want to be close to their kids. Some people are trying even harder to come to the U.S. because, let's say, the U.S. is still better than Mexico, for example. But others I've interviewed are saying, well, maybe this is a time to think about going back. Part of the reason why the podcast is A Better Life with a question mark is a better life still possible, given the economic anxieties, given who's been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19? Something that, honestly, I never really questioned before. I mean, not that I was ever rah-rah America, but I always thought, okay, like, this is a place where immigrants can find a better life. I'm not really so sure anymore.
Yeah. On the surface, the questions that Mia and her mom are asking each other are about just medical care and basic survival. But the thing that's so wonderfully surprising about their story was that her mom was also confronting some pretty essential questions about the places she'd chosen to live and what her relationship was with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she's having to weigh, like, what does it really mean after so long to be in America, to fit in America? And what are also the kind of sacrifices? I mean, I think about this all the time with my parents who are immigrants from Tanzania. Like, what are the sacrifices that they've had to make? Like, I'm in Portland, Maine, and it's not the most diverse state. In fact, I think it's the least diverse state in the country. And, you know, when my mom visits, whenever this pandemic is over, I worry, when we go out, will she feel uncomfortable going out for dinner? My mom recently started wearing the hijab or the Islamic headscarf. And I don't know. I mean, Maine has a pretty high number of hate crimes per capita. So these are conversations that are painful, and there's no easy answer. And that's partly why I'm so honored to be part of this podcast, because there's a variety of answers that we get throughout our episodes. Some are saying, yeah, like, this is still the place they want, and they're going to double down on trying to make a life possible. And others are feeling conflicted. And I would say that most are feeling conflicted, like Mia's mom.
There's a second story in episode one about this woman named Elsa Dunwan, who came to the U.S. with her husband when he got a job in the States. And her folks are still in Mexico. And it's something, I think it's a story a lot of people can relate to, because it's about being far away from someone you love who's very sick. Her parents get the coronavirus, and she decides she's going to go down and take care of them. And it just drives home the questions that a lot of people who have family in other countries might be feeling right now. Is that something you think you'll explore further in the series?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have some episodes where, even though the infrastructure is crumbling in the United States and is quite poor, especially the health infrastructure, it's still better than in other countries. Elsa has a quote in the episode. I think it's like, when America gets a sneeze, Mexico gets the flu, which is, things are so much worse there than they are here. And so Elsa is is grateful to be in the United States and grateful for the healthcare that she's been able to receive. And so that's the thing. If you are of means, you still can get better healthcare. But what are the sacrifices then that one has to make, even if you do get better healthcare? Do you really feel like you fit in? Like, what are you leaving behind?
You know, you alluded to the fact that very often American political debate about these issues gets stopped cold with an America love it or leave it kind of ethos. What do you feel like we miss when we discuss an immigrant experience in those terms and don't leave more room for some of the subtleties of the conversation?
It's funny, like when I was teaching at the University of Michigan, so I taught creative writing, I used to tell my students, it's like, think about your favorite sports team. You know, you support them even though you find that there's a lot of flaws in your team. So I see this with my friends who are Knicks fans, you know, or Detroit Pistons fans. And I feel like with so many of the immigrants that we've interviewed, they feel the same way about the United States. They might have their criticisms, they might wish things were different, but for them, their patriotism doesn't oftentimes derive on who's in office or what the government is like, but from other interactions, like they might love the parks. Like in Maine, so many of the people in the Somali community that's been so deeply impacted by COVID, they tell me, I love Maine and I don't want to leave because I'm attached to the ocean, I'm attached to the parks, I'm attached to the mountains, I'm attached to the people. So patriotism doesn't just have to derive from how our government is faring or who's in power. What if we shifted our definition of patriotism? What if we allowed for more gray area where people can say, well, on some days, just like with your sports team, on some days you like it, some days you don't, but you're still going to support it. And I wanted more complexity in this podcast. And I'm happy that we've given immigrants a chance to sort of tell their own stories.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is writer Zahir Jen Mohammed. He's the host of a new podcast called A Better Life that concerns the experiences of American immigrants. Zahir, there was a time in this country when immigration and refugee immigration was more defined by white Western European immigrants, when Irish American people and German American people were reviled in a lot of the ways that we see people from Somalia, you know, people from China being reviled these days. And there's, you know, it's like there's been this acclimation process by which those, you know, Irish, German, Italian people all suddenly became identified as white over time. And a lot of the fear-mongering that was associated with the immigration debates shifted focus so that nowadays, you know, when politicians are trying to whip up fear against immigrants, they're trying to play on white people's fear of brown people and black people or sometimes Asian people. Do you think that America's ever going to get past this stage of perception of immigration?
I'm so glad you mentioned this because, like, so I'm in Maine and the KKK was very active here in the early 1900s, but oftentimes the animus was against, let's say, Catholics or Irish or Italians. Here in Maine, it was against French Canadians. So the KKK was rallying against French Canadians in Lewiston. Today, Lewiston, and I'm working on an episode about Lewiston, has a high concentration of Somalis. And there's a city council member, her name is Safia Khalid, who I interviewed, who's only 24 years old. And there's been a ton of hate against the Somali community. Someone threw a pig's head in a mosque there in 2006. So I think that things are definitely changing the demographics. And there's a minority of Americans that's fearful of that change. And they think, wait a minute, like Maine doesn't look like it used to. At the same time, I will say since the George Floyd protest, I've felt an incredible amount of optimism. I'm usually kind of a half empty glass type of person, but I see all the Black Lives Matter signs. I see the new spaces where people are talking about issues of race and identity. I see the people winning elections. And I think, wow, this is incredible. I see, look at Safia Khalid, 24-year-old Somali woman, came to America as a refugee, I think at the age of 7. And now she's a city council member. It's amazing. So I think partly, like, I know this is going to sound sort of weird, but I look at sort of the younger generation. I look at some of the conversations that during my generation, I'm 43, we just didn't have the same conversations of race when I was in high school and college. But now you look at Saturday Night Live and they're making jokes about whiteness. That's progress. I wish things were better. I wish there wasn't this surge of anti-immigrant sentiment. I also wish COVID didn't disproportionately affect black and brown people in America. But I also think that COVID is showing faults in America that we need to address. So I do feel hopeful, and largely it's because of those George Floyd protests. I really was in kind of a dark place in April and May, but then I saw the protests and I saw the incredible amount of support and the solidarity, and I thought, wow, this is beautiful. I've never seen something like this in my life.
Yeah. You're a West Coast guy, and you lived in California. You and I both lived in Oregon for some years, but I feel like you have been such a man of the Midwest in recent years. You were in Columbus, Ohio for a little while, and in Ann Arbor, and now, of course, you're in an entirely different part of the country in the East Coast. But I just wanted to ask you about how your time in the Midwest and its patterns of immigration maybe influenced how you think about America's populations and how they're changing.
I'm so glad you asked that, because I have a soft spot for the Midwest. I think I'll admit that I have my coastal elite biases coming from California. When I moved to Columbus, I encountered this absolutely beautiful, wonderful Nepali community. I think one of the largest Nepali communities in America is in Columbus. One of the largest Somali communities in America is in Columbus, Ohio. And it's I think one of the things that I got frustrated was, oftentimes when we think about, like, you know, middle America, we think of white, you know, let's say, you know, Trump supporters. Well, middle America is also these very dynamic Somali community, very dynamic Nepali community, many of whom are thriving and starting businesses that the city loves. There's a beautiful mural of a Somali woman in Columbus that came up, I think, a year or two ago. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, I used to go to Dearborn, a very dynamic Arab community. A Yemeni individual, Abraham Ayash, just won for state representative, making him the first state elected official from the Yemeni community. So I'm seeing a lot of changes, and I think sometimes people write off what happens in the middle of America, and they think about Ohio, and they think about opioids, they think about Trump voters. I'm not saying that those things don't happen there, but I've learned to see a greater complexity in life in between the coast and to really appreciate the possibilities there. I also think that sometimes that places like California that are so progressive, and I put that in quotes, oftentimes have problems of race because they don't have those tough conversations. Whereas in Columbus, there are those tough conversations. At least I saw them. In California, people think, oh, we're good, everything is fine. But I mean, we've seen all these anti-Asian attacks in the Bay Area, for example, after COVID-19. I mean, this is the Bay Area. The Bay Area is super, super diverse. I love the Bay Area. So I think people can be sometimes more vigilant in places that they know they have a history of racial strife, and how can they address that? So I have a soft spot for the Midwest, and I think people write it off really easily, but there's wonderful, dynamic communities of color that are thriving. I think as journalists, our responsibility is to really get out of the way and say, okay, you guys got some great stories. Now tell your stories, and we need to sit back and listen.
I can't resist asking, knowing how much you love food and how much you love to eat, if there's anything that you've been turned on to in Maine that you had not had before?
Let's see. Gosh, that's a good question. So obviously the lobster rolls are incredible, and
for
oysters.
Sure.
I have to say the food in Maine is pretty spectacular. But I think that in Maine, one of the things that I've really enjoyed is there's a very large dynamic African diaspora here. So Maine is about 1.5 million people. About 2% of the population is Black, of which a large number are from Africa. Now, my family is from Tanzania. So there's a place that I want to shout out called Burundi Cafe. And they have these like samosas that are very similar to the samosas that my mom made growing up. And so it's lovely to come into community with these dynamic African communities here, many of whom have started coffee shops like Rwanda Bean. And it's lovely. So I think, like, when people think of Maine, they think of lobster rolls. I love lobster rolls. But there's also these other communities as well, too. And so when my friends visit, at least before the pandemic, I try to steer them into these new directions to say, look, Maine is changing. It is the whitest state in America, but the new waves of immigrants are often from Africa, and they're making the state better.
What comes to mind when you think about what would be most helpful for people you profiled who are in really dire situations right now?
No, I think the only other thing just to add is that right now, I think, is such a critical time in the United States. I think part of the reason why I think this podcast is so timely is this is the time in which a lot of states are coming up with their budgets in terms of how much money should be allocated for COVID relief. And I would urge people to look at those numbers and say, well, how much money is being directed to immigrant communities? Because oftentimes immigrants are more disproportionately affected by COVID. And so that to me is something that like I've been following since I had a policy background, like how much money is being given to immigrant communities? Because that's really right now what can be done is how to help immigrant communities. We'll make sure that the money goes to people who are directly impacted by this virus. And oftentimes I haven't seen that happen. So that's the one thing that I would urge people to look out for.
The episodes are dropping on Thursdays, and the podcast is called A Better Life with a question mark from Feet Into Worlds Productions. And the host of the podcast is Zahir Jen Mohammed, a Zell Writing Fellow at the University of Michigan. Zahir, it's great to hear your voice, and we're glad to hear you're doing okay.
Thank you so much, April, for having me. My pleasure.
Coming up, a statewide view of the challenges that districts, teachers, and parents are trying to sort out as schools restart.
Got districts saying, how many schools will we have to shut down? Are we going to have to lay off a few teachers? Are we talking about laying off 20% of our teachers?
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Educators are racing to lay plans for school. Governor Whitmer recently signed legislation spelling out the rules for funding, attendance, student benchmarks, and more. For a 10,000-foot view of the obstacles in the last few weeks of summer, Amber Arellano joins us. She's the executive director for Education Trust Midwest. Amber, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
You know, we talked a little bit earlier on the show this week to folks who were involved in the Lansing negotiations. And generally speaking, there's some approval for the bills from teachers' unions. Generally speaking, some disapproval from school superintendents in the state's biggest metro area. Can you give us a little backstory on how the people who negotiated this deal feel about it? What would you say the thinking was that both the governor and her allies and Republican leaders in the legislature needed these bills to do?
Yeah, so I think there was a few tension points. One is, you know, there's a century plus old tension point in most states, including Michigan, on, you know, the role of state leadership and government in public education versus local control. That's always a tension point, and it certainly was in this package as well. So questions like, how much should the state defer to districts in terms of setting their own protocols around COVID? You know, how much latitude to give districts in terms of, you know, setting standards for virtual instruction? Should there be a standard, for example, for how many hours of live instruction that schools should have to give to students when so many teachers will have to be working from home and oftentimes caring for their own children? So a whole host of real struggles that are specific to COVID-19, but also, I think, just in general, reflect kind of the dynamics in the state of trying to get the right things right, trying to figure out what the best role is for state leadership and when to defer to local school districts and schools to make the decision making.
At the end of the day, the bills did not insist that all schools have in-person instruction. Instead, they call for all of Michigan's school districts to prioritize in-person learning for grades K through 5 whenever possible. If we step out of the language of bills and into real life, how much leeway do you think that equates to?
I think there's a lot of leeway, but I think what's really setting the parameters for locals is a couple things. One, COVID-19 and, you know, what is the local rate of spread? What does that look like? That's going to look really different in Marquette, you know, versus Flint versus the west side of the state. It has for months now, and that I'm sure that will continue to be the case. You know, there may be a point in the Upper Peninsula in the coming weeks and months that there have been no cases for weeks, and it could make sense for schools to fully reopen, where in another part of the state, the rates could be doubling or tripling. So that makes a lot of sense. And then there's questions around budgets. We still really don't have clarity on how much is Congress going to support local public schools in this next stimulus package. Those talks have been delayed. Local administrators are in a terrible position right now. and trying to make decisions about how many teachers can they afford? Can they even afford to open all of their schools? Will some schools need to be shuttered? There's just a lot of questions that state lawmakers can't actually answer. We don't know right now on how much the federal government is going to help backfill school budget deficits. And it's also unclear how much money the state will have. So I think that they tried to do as much as they could in providing clarity at a really kind of uncertain moment as we head into this new school year.
For sure. I mean, here we are just a couple of weeks from the start of the school year, and there still is no education budget. How worried are you about that?
It's extraordinary. Lots of people use the word unprecedented when it comes to this moment we're living in COVID-19, but to get this close to a school year, there are so many districts that we've talked to. You know, they've been waiting for months now to see what that federal stimulus package was going to look like. Most people thought it was going to be done in June. It's still not done. Now it looks like the talks could go into September. Because of the changing nature of the economic projections, a lack of clarity on how many state dollars are going to be available. And so, you know, you've got districts saying, how many schools will we have to shut down? Are we going to have to lay off a few teachers? Are we talking about laying off 20% of our teachers? This is just a moment of great empathy for everyone, for administrators, for teachers. It's going to be really hard for parents to go into another school year with so much uncertainty. And obviously the kids, I mean, kids are, you know, really bearing the brunt of all of the lack of clarity. But it really does start with DC, though. I mean, I think state leaders are trying to make decisions in a vacuum and this lack of federal leadership. And that's so urgent right now. And like many other states, Michigan's going to have to make decisions with so much unknown information. And we'll probably then have to recalibrate possibly every month in terms of budgets. So it's going to be a really, really difficult fall.
The bills passed by the legislature say that per pupil funding from the state to Michigan schools will be based mostly on last year's attendance. And the superintendents were just pushing back really hard on that. Can you shed any light on why this is such an important issue for them, that they would even be concerned about some of the funding being based on who is enrolled right now?
Well, think about it. I mean, anecdotally, there was a lot of talk among parents and even through this fall that private schools were better positioned to provide more live instruction, whether it's in person or whether it's virtual. There's a lot of concern among traditional public school leaders that they're going to lose significant numbers of students to private schools and to other kinds of school options. And that could have a really big impact in terms of attendance and then budgets at a time when our economy is teetering. You know, that's why this attendance issue is such a huge issue. I think there's another debate that we'll see is how much money should go to shoring up other parts of the state budget and how much money should come from the K-12 budget in order to do that. You know, we've been saying this is a critical moment to protect K-12 education. Our students are facing unprecedented learning losses. You know, some kids as much as 2 to 3 years. We're talking about vulnerable students. And not only do we need to protect the investment in students, but really when in prioritizing vulnerable students. I mean, as difficult as it's going to be for me and for tens of thousands of parents all over the country this fall and trying to keep up a job and essentially doing virtual learning, which is in many ways an augmented form of homeschooling. Imagine what it would be like if your child had a significant learning disability. Imagine if you didn't speak English and you're working on an all English platform, or you're working with, you know, a brand new teacher, a substitute teacher that, you know, doesn't speak the language that you speak. I mean, you think about the needs of English language learners, the needs of low income students, students in rural areas that don't have internet access. Districts are scrambling to try to ensure that they'll even be able to get on a virtual learning platform. As many challenges as that families and educators are going to face this fall, those kids, the kids in the greatest needs, have to be prioritized. That's what we're really encouraging our state leaders to keep those kids in mind, because all kids deserve a chance to learn at a high level. All kids deserve a chance to have access to a great public education, even in a time of a pandemic.
Your staff at Education Trust has been talking with stakeholders and doing research for weeks now. What do you feel rise to the level of being the top line concerns for the start of school? Is it still technology or testing or even just the PPEs that'll be needed to try to make school a safer place?
You know, more and more districts are announcing every day that they're going to be providing instruction online. At least they'll be starting the school year online. And I think given how things have gone so far during COVID-19, that could go on for months. So I think the digital access will be huge. But I also think there's going to be these really huge challenges in terms of staffing. I mean, if you're a district that's getting 20% cut in your budget and you can't afford to keep all your teachers, and now you have students learning at home, and you might not even have the money to have teachers for all the classrooms that will be learning online. Or in some cases, teachers who are facing hugely difficult decisions about, can they do a great job in teaching their students while also supporting their own kids at home? I have a lot of friends who are teachers, and a number of them are saying, like, I don't think I can do both well, and I think I need to take a step back from the profession, or I'm going to leave. I worry about the short term in terms of staffing with qualified, certified teachers in their subject area. You know, in the long run, if we have a number of teachers retiring or not coming back to school because of the challenges that they're facing or concerns about safety, having the talent shortages, particularly in high poverty, urban and rural areas, that could be generated from all of this, not just for this school year, but for the next few years. I mean, these are really big challenges. If you look at what the research shows, kids generally learn at a lower level when they have a teacher that's not been trained to teach math and they're teaching math, or a teacher that, you know, was certified to teach science and now they're teaching government or, you know, language arts. So we're going to face some pretty extraordinary challenges in just making sure that kids have qualified, well-supported, credentialed teachers in every classroom in the state in September.
Amber Arellano is Executive Director for Education Trust Midwest. Amber, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
We'd like to invite you to join us tonight for an extended online discussion of the school restart. I'll be hosting this evening's Issues in AIL. Check the Michigan Radio Facebook page for all the details. One of the hopeful spots on the Republican ticket this year is Senate candidate John James. He's challenging the incumbent Democrat, Senator Gary Peters, running largely on his record as a military veteran and a business owner and one of the party's few black candidates. James gave Senator Debbie Stabenow a closer race than many expected back in 2018, and many in the GOP are hoping that James' personal story and message of economic empowerment will win over voters. Today, though, the Detroit Metro Times has published a story taking a closer look at James' company and his claims that he's never benefited from government assistance. Metro Times editor-in-chief Lee DeVito wrote the story, and he joins us now. Lee, welcome back to Stateside. John James' company, James Group International, is a family firm. Can you tell us a little more about what it does?
Yeah, so the company was started, as the company lore tells it, in the 70s by John James's father, who is also named John James, with just one truck and one business partner. It grew into a global force since then, mostly working with the big three, helping to move, you know, its products around the world and help put a spotlight on John James, you know, like, you know, from his first major TV interview with Fox News, you know, he touted the many jobs that he alleges his company has created.
Yeah, and he started as operations director there and has now risen to run the company. Is that right?
Yeah, he's at the top, CEO, yeah.
James Group International is also part of Detroit's downtown success story. Can you talk about how it came to have a location in the heart of downtown?
Yeah, in the 90s, Governor Engler started an initiative called the Renaissance Zones, which the idea was to bring, you know, development to economically distressed regions. So James Group International appears to have created a subsidiary company, you know, solely for the purpose of utilizing this zone. It was called Renaissance Global Logistics. The zone is in Southwest Detroit, not far from the Ambassador Bridge. So it established, you know, facility there. And, you know, beyond the Renaissance Zone tax break, which was with the state, It also got a federal empowerment zone designation. So those two overlapping zones made it one of the most tax abated, you know, areas in the state. And then on top of that, Renaissance Group International got $2 million in taxpayer money to clean up the 16-acre site.
So from the documents that you were able to obtain for your story, it looks like this subsidiary, RGL, agreed to create jobs as part of its deals to get
yes.
tax breaks. And yet those jobs didn't materialize. Do we know why?
You know, I think the company would say that it's a fluid thing, that there's, I think in the documents even, they kind of tried to get ahead of the fact that they weren't going to make good on their promise to create the jobs. And, you know, they blamed it on, you know, the austerity demanded by the auto industry, which, you know, was just kind of clawing back from, you know, the bankruptcies about a decade ago. But the thing is that the thing that James says on the campaign trail is that, you know, they grew the company from 35 million to 137 million and added 100 jobs in Michigan and east of the Mississippi. You know, it seems like adding that and east of the Mississippi clause in there maybe gives them some wiggle room to say, okay, maybe we lost some jobs in Detroit, but we gained them, you know, at other facilities. But, you know, the term, it's very, very straightforward story revealed in these documents. You know, the terms of the tax break was that they had to create 100 jobs in Michigan in that zone on top of a baseline of about 100 jobs. And there's a lack of transparency in the figures, the employment figures of the company, but in the company's own figures that they self-reported to Crane's Detroit Business in their annual reports, it looks like they lost jobs in Michigan.
Lee, how strict is the state in holding businesses to the kind of job creation measures that tend to get drawn up in these agreements?
You know, that's a good question. I didn't really zoom out to look at that. But in this particular case, you know, like a lot of times if a party, you know, violates the terms, they'll be forced to pay the money back. That doesn't appear to have happened in this case. But, you know, the state through the Michigan Economic Development Corporation did terminate the tax break as a result of the violation.
John James' brother, Lauren, wrote to the state at one point asking, he was trying to see if he could get the terms of this extended so that the company could have a little bit longer time to show some progress. And he said that by lean manufacturing standards, it's actually a good thing that they didn't have as many jobs. I mean, what about that argument? What about the fact that by some measures, a business is successful, especially a manufacturing business, if it can keep its staffing levels pretty low?
I asked the James campaign for comment numerous times, and they declined. But, you know, if they did, I would love to ask John James that very question that you just posed. Like, what is a business that takes taxpayer assistance if it's not helping to create jobs for people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Because you're saying that's a note that he's been sounding on the campaign trail, that it's not good to take government assistance, like right now, for example, in a time of pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe in and of itself, the claim that he added 100 jobs in Michigan and east of Mississippi would be, you know, something, you know, it sounds like it can be disputed. But, you know, saying that and then railing against government assistance, and then also, you know, the company in these emails saying that the tax breaks were necessary and it gave them a competitive edge. You know, just when you mix it all together, yeah, I do think it's worth asking John James about.
There's a cohort of voters out there who said yes to Donald Trump, even though he kind of makes no bones about the fact that he has taken advantage of government subsidies or tax breaks whenever he could get them. Do you think at the end of the day that voters in the Senate race will really care about this?
I think there is this attitude of don't hate the player, hate the game. If people are utilizing loopholes and tax breaks and, you know, whatever other sort of help they can get, that, you know, you shouldn't blame them for doing that. It's an interesting argument, but with so many people suffering, I just think that we need to have a real talk about the way that corporations are treated and the way that everyday Americans are treated.
Lee DeVito is editor-in-chief at the Detroit Metro Times, and you can read his story about James Group International online right now. Lee, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.